With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public, free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom, and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.
You're with Counterculture here on Reality Check Radio with Marie, and as we do every time this week, a time to catch up with Marty Gibson for Media Matters. How are you, Marty?
I'm good, Marie. How are you?
I'm good.
I've been a little bit traumatised by some of your content.
Yeah, yes. As you have probably, as you've heard, it's been a big morning for content, and it is. It's one of those shows that when I was pulling it all together, it's hard because it's difficult stuff to listen to, but it is so vitally important because no one else is talking about it.
Yeah. I sense that this is going to be one of those shows where, I mean, a lot of my backed up rage is about things that no one's talking about as well. And I think, I think that really cuts to the heart of so much of what's going on in the media at the moment. We're just seeing this narcissistic rage from people whose job it is to maintain an idea that things aren't changing, things are stable. They're just not. The dysfunction we're seeing is the tip of an iceberg, and we're on the brink of some problems that have been bubbling under the surface, and we could be seeing some liquefaction, and we've got to have a serious plan and seriously confront what's going on.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. And look, and I actually pre-recorded that interview with Heidi because of time differences. She's in Kansas City. I was able to share it with you so you could digest it ahead of this. And I also was talking to a VFF Hawke's Bay meeting on the weekend, and I said, look, this interview is coming up. You guys need to really listen to this. It's probably one of the most important interviews I've done since I've been with the station. And then I get the newspapers. I go and collect all the newspapers on my way home. And one of the articles in there, in the review section, was this big article on porn here in New Zealand. And I thought, wow. And not only that, also in the Herald on Saturday, along with that porn article, it wasn't the Herald
on Saturday.
Sunday Star Times, the porn article. And the Herald on Saturday, just in the in-brief, you've got to look at those little ones.
Yeah.
In the in-brief, Prime Minister targeted in porn deepfake. Italian Prime Minister Giorgia Meloni is suing a father and son accused of creating deepfake pornographic videos of her and posting them online. A 40-year-old man and his 73-year-old father have been tried for defamation in a landmark civil case in Sardinia after superimposing the face of Italy's first female leader on the bodies of adult film actresses. Police were able to track the men behind the videos via a digital trail left by the smartphones used to upload them to American porn websites. If victorious in the trial slated for July, Meloni has said that she will donate the symbolic sum of €100,000 to fund supporting victims of domestic violence in order to encourage other women not to be afraid to press charges when faced with online abuse. And that was one of the issues that Heidi brought up, was with these AI deepfakes.
Yeah, the AI is about to make all this kiddie porn. And I guess the good thing about that is that people who have shared real porn of themselves can then just claim it's deepfake. So, I mean, there's some glasses half full stuff in there. But, the thing that I never really got explained to me when I was a kid, as well as I could have, was the danger of porn to my limbic system. The neural pathways that it's forming and the distraction it is from actual achievement. That's something that urgently needs to be especially shared with boys. And again, a lot of that, some of that stuff is going against the grain of what's acceptable to talk about. It's not acceptable to talk about boys being failed by the education system because, there's that feminist undercurrent. Well, it's just equity. The thing that never appears in the assessments of the inequalities between schools, they'll dance around the head of a pin on all sorts of levels. They'll never talk about the severe disadvantage that children are at if they grow up without a biological father.
Yeah.
I find, as the father of kids myself, and kids that are getting into the layer of the victims that they were that she was talking about, and also the age of the perpetrators that she was talking about, kind of 11 to 14, you can start to hear kids, a thing that kids do at a young age, 8, certainly, 10, 11-year-olds, is, mimic some sounds of porn. And they don't really know what it is, but it's the sound of someone choking on something. Again, it's something that we've got to take seriously and actually tear out by the root, no pun intended.
No. No, the entire thing is, it just frustrates me. I mean, I was blown away initially when I did the interview with Tony Pitt, and this is what's cascaded this. And Tony said, well, you really should talk to Heidi Olsen. So I got on to Heidi. Just to reiterate some of those numbers, if you're just tuning in now and you didn't catch the interview with Heidi that I did, over 50% and up to 2/3 of child sexual abuse now is child on child.
That's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah, and I think it was the UK was showing nearly 2/3. The one thing that hasn't changed is the around 90% number, which is the number of the perpetrator. 90% of the perpetrators are known to the victim. So that's remained constant. What has changed is who the perpetrators are. And the biggest victims are 4 to 11-year-olds. And the main group of perpetrators now that are starting to come out are 11 to 15-year-olds who are known to them. So generally siblings, cousins, friends, these are who they are. And, it's happened so quickly. As she said, she saw a paradigm shift in 2015. And she said it's only accelerating since then. So a lot of parents just simply haven't caught up. And it was interesting. So this article, the Herald on Sunday article on porn, is there's this new group that have formed, Joe Robertson and Holly Brooker, and they've created a group called Make Sense. And they've been putting pressure on the government to help put filters on these ISP addresses to try and filter out some of the harmful content, which as an idea is admirable. But I just can't. I mean, I literally wrote in the margins of this as I'm going through and I'm reading it. They're almost fighting a rearguard action. Excuse the pun, because if you're dealing with kids, particularly if we're looking at the ages like 11 to 15-year-olds, well, if these kids are digital natives, which they are, 3 letters, VPN.
Yeah, you can keep going with those ideas where we're being culturally hoisted on our own petard. The other one is that we've spent so long having all of these people saying, hey, one thing is just as valid and acceptable as another. It's quite a U-turn for them to make to say, actually, some things really aren't healthy. And just because someone likes doing it and gains some identification through doing it, it doesn't mean we should accept it or tolerate it. The whole tolerant society and diversity in some ways, is playing into our failure to actually form a coherent idea of what's wrong and what's right. And you can hear the gormlessness in that story where the Secondary Principals Association, New Zealand President Vaughan, I should have practiced reading his name, Quilliot, complicated world, isn't it, says Secondary Principals Association President Vaughan Kalhur, on the challenges facing modern youngsters. He said porn also gets a reality check. So his focus is, much like in the movies, when you get shot, you don't stick a plaster on it and carry on running. Similarly, not every man has a 17-foot penis and can shag for 3 hours a night. That's a very non-digital native idea about the problem.
Yeah, and I mean, I brought that up in the interview with Heidi. Because it is so simple when you are like us Gen Xers, to live in our Gen X paradigm of what we think porn is.
Well, his suggestion is parents worried about their kids' potential exposure to harmful content, people or situations, both on and offline, should talk to experts. That's a failing strategy. Most of those experts have been brought up in that neo-Marxist idea that whatever happens in the toilets of a gay club is just as real and valid an expression of love as what happens within the confines of a marital bedroom.
Yeah.
He's not getting there.
No, and let's face it, I mean, it's not as if the experts have led us down a very positive path in recent years. I think I get to a point now if someone says to me, oh, but I'm an expert in this, or this is, you know, we need to listen to the experts. Right, do we actually?
Well, you've got to remember there are laws in place to prosecute experts who do what could be regarded as, what do you call it, not deprogramming? Pray away the gay or anything.
Oh, conversion therapy.
Yeah, conversion therapy. There are legal ramifications that would deter a lot of people from talking to kids about how maybe some sexual choices are more harmful than others.
Oh.
Thanks, Labor.
Yeah. And, I mean, let's not crack that chestnut today because, believe me, I've got a lot to say about that as well. Actually, I'm going to let's just head down that pathway for a second.
All right.
Just for a second, and then we'll go back. I know, both you and I are a bit sort of fractious today. Because, of course, in this country, we know who led the charge on that legislation, which was Chenille.
Mm.
And Chenille's not in the Herald anymore, so we can't, you know. But I hear he's cropped up. I hear he's cropped up now as a writer, a spin doctor for a Labour MP. Oh, bless. Anyway, hopefully.
You know, the problem isn't the narcissistic, confused people who end up in those positions. The problem are the people who are pulling their strings and look for narcissistic, high anxiety people to put in those positions who you look bad when you criticize because they're victims. You know, the problem isn't Jacinda. The problem are the people who maybe she ended up at Checkers with and they saw she was anxious. Maybe she liked, you know, she was a DJ, put that in inverted commas and work out what goes with that. She's someone who was chosen for that. She ended up as, you know, the president of young socialist youth. Let's turn the world into something that works for the WEF and then turn it up as a WEF young global leader. Mm. They're puppets. Yeah. So the problem, if we keep looking at the puppets and blaming them, we're never going to get to the top of the strings. We've got to find out where the strings go.
Yeah. So a lot of this, too, is this desensitization and also demoralization of the traditional family structure. And you hinted to it before. And I see this being just the same. You know, we've got this new permissive society out there now. And it's really difficult, I think, for kids to find those boundaries. And Heidi mentioned it. You know, you've got kids that are consuming this porn. It's easily accessible for them. When we were kids, we had drummed into a stranger danger, inappropriate touching, you know, how to identify the ick, right?
Mm.
How to identify the ick, how to know what is good and what is bad. Well, those lines are now completely blurred for our children. Throw in that the social overlay that a lot of them now no longer have strong male role models living in homes with them, and that a lot of women are having to sort of carry this burden on their own.
Sometimes men popping up offering to be helpful babysitters who really shouldn't be babysitters.
Indeed. So, you know, you've got all of that going on. And that's the one thing that article sort of didn't really address. I mean, the whole article was, this is sort of going on, but it never went into the depth of what the problem was like in New Zealand. You have that principal who is sort of trying to sort of kind of brush it away, like, oh,
yeah,
really?
Thinking about the penthouses under his dad's bed still.
Yeah, he's in that mindset. These two women with their organization are trying to do something, but it's almost like they're trying to sort of, you know, with a feather duster, clean away, you know, decades of grime and filth. And it's just going to take so much more than that. And in a way, only way to clean away that filth is going to have to be with the responsibility of parents. And parents are going to have to do that. And then the difficulty is you've got a whole generation of children that are not necessarily two parents, but maybe only one parent, and that's if they've got parents at all, you know, if they're caught in the system. So,
well, you know, I mean, I'll out-pessimistic you here, and I'm sorry, people. Well, I'm sure we'll find some cheer somewhere, but we're writing this all the way down. We're in a state of societal collapse. This has happened time and time again. I've talked about Unwin before, saying in the 80-plus collapsed civilizations he looked at, once you take the stigma off premarital sex and extramarital sex, You got three generations before it hits the ground. We're there now. On on the political panel last week, I quoted Camille Paglia, who I'm very fond of, an American. She's a feminist, but tends to run afoul of a lot of feminists because she is, which is actually sex positive and porn positive. But she argues, and I quoted this on the political panel last week, that from the Greeks to the Romans to now, homosexuality, gender fluidity, etc., what a culture ends up becoming right before its downfall. The downfall is brought on by cultures around the dominant culture that are more rigid in gender roles. So someone who has got their act together in terms of morality comes and takes over. And she said, people who live in such times feel that they're very sophisticated, they're very cosmopolitan, but in truth, they are evidence of a civilization that no longer believes in itself. That's where we are. So it's not a case of cleaning up the mess. It's a case of almost fashioning escape pods from it.
Yeah.
That's where we are. And so, as I said, this time we spend arguing about the drag queens in the library, we haven't even started yet, but that's going on.
We're about to argue about the drag queens in the library.
Soon to be ex-editor's pick of the Gisborne Herald, soon to be owned by someone else. All of that stuff, you can argue it, but it's like punching a tar baby. You're better off going, yeah, that's what happens. What are we going to do? How are we going to tell our kids that, hey, you've got to steer clear of this because the outside world is kind of a little bit sick.
Yeah, one of the things I quite enjoyed about the political agenda last week was actually having Bob McCroskrey there, and he was able to bring in a avenue of faith into that conversation. Now, as I like to say, I'm faith adjacent. I don't hold faith, but I really do like the tenets and the values with faith. We've got our kids in a faith-based school because we want to be able to, for them to concentrate on just essentially education as much as they can. And there is certainly this degeneration within the family structure, because one of the places where the family structure was really strong was in that faith environ. And so that leads us to the drag time story hour. So today, Wednesday, is Hastings is where there is currently this tour is cropped up. And I know that there is going to be a protest there in Gisborne, where we're from. There has been a protest there in recent days, where directly across the road from the library in Gisborne is a rainbow pedestrian crossing, which has been there for a few years now. I know the last few times I've been back, it's been there. There was last year, these drag queens came to Gisborne Library and did a drag story hour. And this year, local members of the Destined Church were certainly not happy about it. So they went out one evening, a couple of evenings ago, and painted over it and painted it white. And those videos can be found on social media because they'd basically fed up. Now, I don't have an issue with drag queens at all. In fact, I like me a good drag queen, particularly in an R18 club, if I'm watching some comedy or some performance art, because they are performers, the good ones are. That's what they're about. What I have an issue with is that you're taking adult performers, placing them in a public environment for anybody to go and attend in our youngest and smallest minds. And this is the one thing that people are not focusing on. They're all focusing on this is the drag queens. Not once anywhere are they actually looking at the books that they're reading the children. They're not reading the kids Hungry Caterpillar or Where the Wild Things Are or Down the Back of the Chair or Going on a Bear Hunt, which actually, when you think about all of those titles, actually could actually potentially have
you connotations. You could make it without too much effort, couldn't you?
Exactly. Anywho, it's not any of those titles.
All the shaved-headed mothers with piercings and tats, grinning away, no fathers in sight.
And what they're reading are books. I actually went to a lot of effort to try and find the books that they were going to be reading. The only one book that I found in any article that was mentioned was Giraffes Don't Dance, which in itself is actually a nice book about a giraffe that wants to go to a dance.
I've read it.
Yeah, it's a lovely book, and that one is fine. But there's a reason why they only mentioned that one. Because the rest of them, and there's a list for drag story hours that's available for the United States, and I know that these two have drawn from that list. The rest of the books are all heavily based in either critical race theory or queer theory. So essentially, they're taking these children's books, reading them titles, which are indoctrination for our youngest wee minds.
Yeah.
And you've got a whole bunch of feckless parents who have chosen to go, particularly if they're of the woke persuasion, because they're there that because they're wanting to support their trans allies and not thinking about the poison that's going into these kids' minds. And I feel like it's parental child abuse. But well, hey, you know, not my pig, not my farm. So
yeah, I mean, and getting back to the terrible issues that kids are facing with porn. You know, it's just one more layer on top of that, one more layer of confusion and sexualization.
Yeah.
You know, so maybe they're starting to see things like that.
Mm.
Or maybe it encourages their older siblings to look it up. Or maybe we've got to sort of stop wondering whether we look like big meanies saying, hey, this isn't acceptable, and really look within ourselves about what's acceptable for kids.
Yeah, exactly.
And maybe some parents, you know, it's no point in fighting a parent who wants to take their kid to that.
No.
They're just, as I said, they're riding it all the way down. The important thing is that if you don't want to ride it all the way down, you better start, as I said, making an escape pod.
Mm, yeah. Yeah, absolutely. The other thing that sort of then leads on with this, and it'll be intriguing to see how things go at the Hastings Library today on this, is like one of the books is called Red, and it's about a crayon, right? And it's a crayon that was actually a blue crayon but gets accidentally mislabeled as a red crayon, and actually trying to go through on this journey of discovery to actually help this crayon decide what color crayon it actually is, and all, I mean, it's a grooming book on transgenderism, right? That's what it is. And that's the difficulty, is that when you've got these young minds and they're having been read by books like that, and you're a 3 or 4 year old and you're seeing this on the crayons, and then all of a sudden you're coming home and your 7 or 9 year old brother comes in and wants to lick your crayon. Yeah, where do you go with that? Anyway, which then child abuse in turn, that did crop up in the paper this week on the back of.
Well, it was everywhere, wasn't it? It was scattered right through.
In another case of New Zealand children, who came in on the point of starvation, he could barely walk. Another one beaten so badly, you know, multi broken bones and organ failure.
And no one talking.
No. Again, silence, crickets.
Yeah. In the normal course of events, society corrects because there are a relatively small percentage of the population who aren't scared to stand up to the status quo and go, hey, this is bullshit. That's what the whole Emperor Wears No Clothes story is about. What's happened is there've been efforts to take those gas alarms out of the mine. And that's happened in the form of a captured media that's owned by the same people who print the money and are quite happy for all that's happening. And it's happening by the people who normally who are calling bullshit on the bullshit, being stigmatized. And so the sheepy people, who are far more higher a proportion of the population than they'd like to admit, don't have a path out of the madness. They've just got the Pied Piper of Hamelin leading them further and further away. That's why it's vital that we maintain a very sober and evidence-based narrative that's heavy in questions, and we just keep going. It's that you've got to keep talking thing that your friend Desmet.
Matthias
Desmet always says. It's vital that you keep talking through a move towards authoritarianism.
Yeah, you've got to keep pecking away at the mass. You've got to keep pecking.
Mm. It's got to be water off a duck's back. And also, it's worth pointing out, hey, you know, you're saying we're tinfoil hat wearers or cookers. What are we saying that's wrong? And it's, as I've said on earlier shows, it's very telling that the only real substantive criticism of Reality Check Radio has been the interview we did with the Austrian Martin Zellner, because that's it. And Martin Zellner is just an Austrian version of Te Pāti Māori.
Yes.
He's an ethno-nationalist. They're ethno-nationalists. So, you know, it's very hard to make a worthwhile criticism of what we're doing. We've just got to keep doing it.
Mm. I mean, the good news is that the WPATH files, I think, is starting to have an impact now. I mean, the Scandinavians started making changes in terms of the prescribing of puberty blockers, and we're now starting to see in the UK, of course, in New Zealand, we prescribe at, 10 times the rate, and it will probably be 10 years behind everybody else because we like to do things differently down here. That is the frustration, but at least there is starting to be some cracks in that veneer. But as you said, there will be a portion of people that will need to ride this train all the way to the bottom of the cliff.
And it is vital we form a parallel society almost and demonstrate that it works better.
Indeed. Now, the other thing also dominating the media, and we won't spend too much time on this, but I think it is worthy of a mention, is, of course, the statement of Catherine, the Princess of Wales, around her cancer. And there's been loads of speculation because, of course, she announced she was having abdominal surgery in January, and she was going to be out of public life for a time. And then, of course, she had just not been seen at all. And loads of stories were rife. And then finally she came out and made a statement that she has been diagnosed with abdominal cancer. Now, two things. Firstly, I thought her statement was a masterclass in grace and class, something that I think maybe her sister-in-law should potentially take a leaf out of her page over. Just saying. Secondly, you know, back to the theme we had several weeks ago, there are none so blind that those who will not see. So, you know, the royal family, you know, Sarah Ferguson, she has gone through a mastectomy and has a breast cancer. King Charles is currently undergoing treatment for prostate cancer. Now you've got Catherine, who, I mean, she's barely, 40? She's now got this abdominal cancer, followed up then by the Herald in a lifestyle article, which I think was initially published by the Telegraph in the UK, talking about the high rates of abdominal cancer that are now starting to appear in those under 30. And experts are at odds to explain what a mystery why it's happening. Anyway, there are none who are so blind who will not see. Anyhow.
Yeah.
Yeah. Speaking of trains riding it all the way down to the bottom of the cliff, public service, they're still crying. Wah, wah, wah.
Where do we start with that? There was a lot about that, wasn't there?
Well, let's start with Chris Hipkins having his State of the Nation, which received nowhere near the column inches that Winston's received, I have to say. His line, heartless and cruel, that these public service cuts are heartless and cruel. Really, Chippy? Yeah. Heartless and cruel.
If you want to listen to an RCR replay, have a listen to, I mean, you should listen to the whole show because it's awesome, but Cam Slater's interview with Dave Farrar and Simon Lusk.
Brilliant.
Just three of New Zealand's absolutely best political operatives and minds and pollers together. It was, and you know, the hilarious thing is, they laid out the path for Labour to get back into power, just for free, just laid it out.
Yeah, but when ideology stands in the way of common sense, Martin.
Well, good. Long may it continue to do so. That was so worthwhile. Really great segment.
Yeah, it was very, very good. So, of course, Hipkins is now, his speech, uninspired by many. And again, it's like, as you said, they've been the arsonists who have set the fire. Yeah, they're standing around complaining about how hot it is.
Yeah, and I think the fire service should be doing a better job to put it out. Yeah, I mean, what I was getting at with that segment was they just laid out how he just had, and I think to use Cam's expression, tits for hands, with everything he touched turned to disaster. Just the gall of the man to still be up there complaining about the fire, the way the fire service is putting out his fire, his little ratty beady eyes and his little sausage roll fingers, just go away. And there was a hagiography of Grant Robertson, Thomas Coughlin. There was a lot of articles in the paper this weekend written by people who figure if they agree with smart people and rich, successful people, they'll either be right or have a good prospect of getting some good job in PR. But you could hear, like, just really didn't, sort of had a glancing insight into the way he was controlled by the Reserve Bank. But the article, it was a very long interview, ended. After decades in Wellington, Robertson is on his way south to Dunedin, where he will become the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Otago. He told the Herald he has never burned a couch, despite spending his youth in Dunedin, and he doesn't plan to start burning them now. And, you know, it's obviously sort of one of those, oh, we're kind of friends, oh, he's a good guy. But what he's really sort of telegraphing with that is, we were hopelessly compromised and unable to objectively assess how bad these guys were. We didn't have the mental horsepower. You know, we got sort of taken in by the jolly, you know, they seem like nice people. We're not going to follow the puppet strings up.
I summed up that entire article as, oh, soz, not soz.
Yeah.
Sorry, not sorry. That's literally how it felt.
Hide you'd have to still be around.
Well, the thing that annoys me is that you have the likes of Robertson, who has, I think, behaved so appallingly, has been literally the worst finance minister. I think he's even worse than Robert Muldoon back in the day.
That's the consensus, isn't it? Yeah. Among serious political commentators.
Yeah.
Michael Bassett.
And he gets rewarded with a plum job. And I just, for me, that annoys the living tits off me. It really does. But there you go. The other thing that cropped up was in terms of the cuts, right? So they're trying to, you know, they've got all these public sector cuts. You've got big numbers now. IMBY's the latest to be crying. Corrections are saying, well, we can't figure out how we're going to make these cuts of 7.5% in our department when 89% are frontline workers, and you're telling us we can't cut frontline workers. Ultimately, at the end of the day, the cuts need to be made. As you and I said last week, these people are going to have to turn up somewhere. And I think for a number of them, they're going to actually have to enter the real world and actually perform on the metric in companies in the real world, where actually input and output are generally measured as a form of your performance,
yeah,
not the fact that you've turned up to drink your plunger coffee and how many meetings you've attended. So, you know, that's going to be quite a paradigm shift. And it's also going to be that with the media as well. And they're also staring down the barrel of that, because in the previous 6 years, when there were actually a lot of media jobs going and things were contracting and shrinking and changing within that media landscape, where did 50% of the journalists, New Zealand journalists, suddenly reside in those 6 years? Well, they all became spin doctors within the government. So there's going to be a lot of unemployed journalists floating around.
Yeah, I mean, they had a big article about restraint of trade clauses. I 100% agree with that. You know, there are onerous restraint of trade clauses. They're not legally enforceable, but who wants to risk going to court? It's just another sort of handbrake by bureaucracy on New Zealand's productivity. And I'd argue, I mean, Air 2 Union is arguing against them. A representative said that clause had been negotiated out of collective agreement for unionised Starbucks workers. I mean, ridiculous that you could stop a barista moving somewhere else. And he said research overseas indicated banning restraint of trade clauses for middle and lower paid workers lifted wages, White said, who provided a sheaf of evidence to the Select Committee. A representative of the Taxpayers Union told the Select Committee that regulating restraint of trade will result in workers being paid less. But when White asked if he had read the research, he admitted he had not. Yeah, that's ridiculous. But I would argue against the restraint of trade clauses. And I'd also argue for a German-style system where it's real easy to sack people, and as a result, the stigma from getting sacked is less, and you have a much more flexible labour market.
Mm.
You know, you want to know where New Zealand's productivity problem is. Talk to a builder, ask them how busy they are. They'll inevitably say, "Oh man, I'm just flat out." And when you say, "Why don't you hire someone?" they act like you've just punched them in the guts. They normally double over to say, "Oh, God, no." The fact that you've got someone who's got the skill can't hire someone to do the donkey work and get more work done. The fact that he's doing stuff and doesn't have the flexibility to train someone, that's a big handbrake on productivity. So they've got to free up the labour market before they release a lot of bureaucrats into it.
Mm.
Because a lot of those guys will get into private jobs and they'll just be the union guys. I don't know about that. We've all hired those people, the number fours, the people who look at you and think, look at all the money that prick's making. Why should I slave my guts out just to make him richer?
Mm-hmm. Oh, speaking, did you see Shane Tupou? His little rant on that respect.
Yeah.
What did he call it? Luxon of the Seven Houses.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, it was a pretty weak column, wasn't it? Even worse is what's happening to disabled people in the whānau. Reading that and reading a few of the other ones just made me even surer that those cuts were made by a bureaucrat who was maybe tied up with Labour and wanted to give National some bad press. Oh, you want us to cut? Okay, we'll cut it right where most New Zealanders think, if my taxes are going anywhere, I'd like them to go to support those there but for the grace of God go I parents who have to look after a severely disabled child. I'm happy with my tax going there. It's like people collecting for child cancer. It's like, well, I would have hoped that with the $90 billion extra debt, some of it would have gone to child cancer. You know, that I'd be happy with a bit of that.
Yep. Hey, did you see they finally announced the new political editor for TVNZ, and it looks like they decided to put the Mao into Māori as opposed to the Marxist into Bradford.
Well, they're writing it all the way down.
Yeah, they sure are. So, Stephen Joyce.
Right. I mean, Paula Bennett pretty much dialed it into, didn't she, wasn't it?
Yeah, actually, let's go Paula Bennett before we go to Stephen Joyce, because I thought Paula Bennett's was very good. And because, just in the sense that she had some data there, and it is actually, again, something that I expected to see more of in the paper, was around retail crime and those retail crime stats that have come out. And there were two things that sort of struck me. One was some of the numbers, really eye-watering numbers. So in New Zealand, 148,599 retail crimes in 2023, so essentially just shy of 150,000, versus 50,000 in 2020.
Mm. And again, getting back to the porn thing, talking about the sexual assaults going up in those.
Yeah.
Some of that stuff's bubbling through, and there's a whole lot more underneath what we're seeing.
And when you say, 69 sexual assaults in Auckland alone in 2023 in retail environs. Now, I think it's safe to assume that most of those will be not people that know each other. These are just randos on randos. If that's the case, and we know that over 90% of all sexual assaults are by people that you know, that's a really terrifying number when you think that these are the ones that people, these are the in that absolute minority. So that's terrifying. And six retailers a day are being assaulted at work.
Mm.
Those are appalling numbers. Appalling numbers. I know Mark Mitchell has got a lot on his plate with this one, an absolute huge amount on his plate. I subscribe to the Epoch Times, which is an American media outlet. And actually Trevor Loudon, who I had on last week, he has a show and contributes to Epoch Times. And anyhow, they interviewed Yanya Kallik, who does a great series called American Thought Leaders. And he talks to a whole variety of different people. And Jeffrey Tucker, who I've interviewed here, is also the economic spokesperson there for Epoch Times. He interviewed just recently the Louisiana governor, Jeff Landy, who used to be the Louisiana Attorney General. Now, Louisiana, which is where New Orleans is, that's always had an issue with crime. It did for a number of years. It peaked after Hurricane Katrina. At one point, New Orleans was the murder capital of, I think, not only the country, but the world. I mean, crime was really, really rampant. When Landy became AG and then now latterly governor, one of the things that he talked about in terms of turning those statistics around, and they have started to turn those statistics around in Louisiana and made it a vastly, vastly safer place, was as he said, you take care of the small things and the big things take care of themselves.
The and broken him, windows thing.
Exactly. And those small things were things like the retail crime, the shoplifting, the vandalism, the all of those small things. And they started going in at that level.
Yeah. It's saying this behavior is unacceptable. And that's something that Labor were loath to do. Because it's like, those people are underprivileged and inequality, and so they're facing a lot of things, and it's a valid expression of anger to blah, 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 just from people who are too weak to actually stand up and say, hey, that's wrong. You know, again, back to my thing of Luxon's features tell, benefits sell deficit. It's not good for the kids doing the crime. It's bad for them. That's better if they're caught. It's better if they're punished. Whether or not it's boot camps, I mean, I do have, I think it's an appalling word. It's silly of them to get caught in that kind of thing. I mean, you know, it should be the Conservation Corps.
Mm.
They should be pulling forestry slash out of the bush. They should be going to camps. And, you know, that there should be an acknowledgement that some of the people who look for jobs in those kind of areas are exactly the people who should never be allowed near kids or given positions of power. But if you factor that in and you cherry pick the right people to do it, you could have it so kids actually wanted to go there and had fun. And that should be your aim. Say to them, hey, my aim is that you enjoy this. It's not punishing. It's work with me on it. It's going to be uncomfortable at first. It's going to be good for you.
Mm.
Make some friends. You'll get better. It's going to change your life.
Mm. Camaraderie, teamwork.
Yeah.
Because ultimately, the place that you had that was always in an environment of war. Well, you don't want that. I mean, you never want to have an environment of war to send your children to. But if you're able to give them that self-confidence, that camaraderie, that teamwork, a sense of boundaries, understanding, and you can do it in a productive manner, as you said, like a Conservation Corps or
sell it to them. Hey, yeah. Well, you know, if you're going to work with us, you could go on this.
Hmm.
Be out in the bush. You can trap some possums. You can learn to live off the land. You could have a pretty good time. You might get a bit cold. I mean, are you, you know, is it going to bother you?
So the other thing that didn't appear in the paper, and I thought would appear a lot more in the paper, was, of course, the economic number came out this past week, and, you know, we're in a double-dip recession.
Mm.
I mean, to be fair, anyone living in the real world knows this. Stephen Joyce, I think, was really the only person that touched on it. I cannot believe the willful blindness by the media and not wanting to actually look at the real aspects of the financial poo that we're in. They'd much rather focus on the public service jobs being lost and that they need to drop those tax cuts for the rich, don't you know? Oh, they've got to get rid of that to get New Zealand back on track. It's just like, for goodness sake, you know, we're in this recession, right? So just suck it up, buttercup.
Yeah, well, Liam Dan really went to town on that. But, you know, again, figures that if he's agreeing with clever people, he's probably more likely to be right.
Yeah.
Really. He didn't think that people should have more money in their pocket because it's going to be inflationary. He's driven by monetary theory. And he agreed with so much of the boneheaded stuff Robertson was doing. But, yeah, Stephen Joyce probably has a bit much faith in some of Christopher Luxon's friends at BlackRock and international finance. But on the money as far as real politics and what's going on in New Zealand and
Well, he said it here, when I was Minister of Economic Development and Bill English's associate in finance, Bill used to invite me to his regular discussions with the then Governor Graham Wheeler. That was because the Wellington-based bank's data-based view could be a bit backward-looking and was often at odds with what I was seeing in almost my weekly travels around regional New Zealand. I wasn't the only one. Then ANZ Bank Chief Economist Cameron Bagri used to say he learnt a lot about what was actually happening economically by travelling the regions and keeping his ear to the ground. I fear some of the dichotomy is emerging now. From my recent travels around the country, the economy feels much worse than the view the central bankers are seeing. And the danger is that the Reserve Bank will be too late in starting to lower interest rates. the hikes were so precipitous so quickly that their deflationary effect is still working through the system. And if the politicians turn out in this instance to be true to their word of shrinking the public sector, the Reserve Bank may be taken by surprise about how sharp the slowdown actually is. It's finally judged cool, but it's clear the economy won't truly turn up again until the interest rates start to fall.
Yeah. And it's, you know, just when you look at it like that, oh, we've printed too much money and now people are losing confidence in its worthlessness or its worth, we're going to have to charge more money for it so people think it's valuable. It's just so much smoke and mirrors. As Adrian Orr said, it's a great business to be in. We print money and people believe it. You know, it's if you follow the puppet strings, that's kind of where it leads.
Yeah, it does. And he did talk about, too, in terms of the regulatory capture, in terms of freeing things up to allow more investment and positivity. And then you see, of course, the Sale GP debacle down in Christchurch, which is a classic example of that sort of bureaucracy getting in front of innovation and the sheer frustration by Russell Coutts.
Well, you can see the split in New Zealand as well. You read the comments under News Talk ZB's article about it and you get people outraged at the little Napoleons who've been given some power and they've got the opportunity to punish someone who makes them feel bad about themselves because of their achievements and they use it. Mm. And then you go to national radio and you've got a mix, but mostly it's the lefties going, oh, well, you know, these rich people think they can do what they want. And then you go to Te Ao Māori News and the vitriol against him, the good job kind of vibe of so much of it. It's sad. And I come back to that interview with him where he said New Zealand's the hardest place to get things done by a factor of 10. It's 10 times harder than other places. He goes to New York, he'll have a meeting with everyone who's got the power to make it happen. They make it happen. They welcome it. They realise it's good for economic development. Great.
Did you catch the Fourth Estate with Muriel Newman, Peter Williams and Alistair Harding?
I make a point of catching anything which has Muriel Newman in it because I find it so incisive.
The theme of this was very much encapsulated in that panel from Friday. So if anyone else hasn't caught it yet, it's great. And they were talking about, remember, in terms of the poverty, like our most impoverished region in New Zealand is arguably the West Coast, but it's also the one region that's sitting on the greatest number of resources. And, you know, they finally had an opportunity to be able to mine, to bring actually all these jobs to the West Coast. The West Coast has wanted all of these jobs and it was scuppered because of snails. Remember that?
Yeah. You've got that very compelling argument. Do you want your electric vehicles or do you want to ban mining? Because you can't have both. And there's a lot of rare earth minerals down there that, you know, there's a huge market for. And you've got the choice. Well, do you want it done by 7-year-old kids in Africa who are slaves, essentially? Or do you want it done safely and in a way that does look after the environment as much as possible by well-paid people where it creates money that New Zealand can then use to do many other things and dig ourselves out of squealer's hole?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you two things that jumped out at me, again, we're sort of dealing with columns, is old Vernon Small seems to be brushing a bit of the dandruff off his ill-fitting tweed jacket, sort of is kind of almost admitting, he was talking about the policy to boot out Kainga Ora tenants who were bad to their neighbours, was a political winner, and it was unfair that there were a lot of good families who were waiting for housing and it wasn't right that those people should be given preference. So he held his nose and said, equally compelling, though with an unpleasant whiff of the deserving versus the undeserving poor, that's the heart of the problem with socialism, isn't it? Was the argument that with a waiting list of 25,000 families, why should sitting tenants be protected at the expense of those waiting who may be more deserving? So, yeah, he's admitting that we're trudged through the second recession in a tough year, while central bank's inflation concerns remain high, that means our economy is stagflation adjacent, made more likely by rising unemployment exacerbated by thousands of state sector employees facing the chop.
Stagflation adjacent.
Yeah, he's getting close to admitting. But and I thought Andrea Darth Vance wrote an interesting column.
She did, actually.
There's quite a lot of questioning whether it is the right time to have tax cuts. I do think that politically they've probably oversold that. People's mortgages have gone up by $1,000 a month. You know, there's no tax cut that's going to really seriously take the sting off that. The priority has to be getting the economy right as fast as possible.
Well, her criticism of his is, so who's National doing the hokey cokey and getting shaken all about? And her criticism was of Christopher Luxon trying to out corporate.
Yeah. She's worked her whole life as a journalist, pretty much. And so she's missed those points. I mean, I think she's talking about him being too business focused. She doesn't understand that there's sales, which is a vital part of politics, mm-hmm. and there's management. He's a manager and he's over managing it. He's trying to be a CEO, but he could really use a big shot of salesmanship. He lacks it.
Well, the one point I think she completely missed was, as National believes the public service should adopt the brutal efficiencies of the business world, but government isn't a business because the desired outcome is not profitability. No, Andrea, the desired outcome is effectiveness, is delivery, not profitability.
If you're putting the financial drag on the economy by taking money out of the economy, taking it through all your bureaucracy so that by the time it actually gets to the coalface, so to speak, it's lost God knows how much of its value that would have had in the private sector because of all the drag on it through bureaucracy, you better be efficient about it. You better be as efficient as possible, and you better be focused on that rather than the spray and pray approach of, well, pretty much all New Zealand governments, but certainly the Marxist student politicians really set the bar pretty high for that.
Yeah. Hey, do you want to have a final word on Gisman?
I'm going to Gisman this weekend. And,
me too.
Well, that'll be awesome. Catch up, meet the Buskey parents, ask them about my grandparents.
Yeah.
I've spoken a lot about the gang households in Gisman, and I've been on both sides of it. You know, I've been in mob environments, I've been in black power environments. I've had very stern conversations with 15 or 20 Black Power members holding baseball bats and threatening to beat the shit out of my friend and I with them. And, you know, it's all pretty ugly, but, you know, my experiences with them, are the majority are very positive, but it doesn't stop me thinking it's a terrible idea. And as I said, there's a lot of dysfunction that most people just have no idea about bubbling under the surface. And it won't take much of a shake before we get some societal liquefaction.
Yeah, and the whole thing is just utterly, utterly tragic. Just unbelievably tragic. And what came home to me is that Once Were Warriors was filmed 30 years ago, written, 35 years ago? And yet there are still corners of New Zealand where it could have been written yesterday. Yeah. And I just feel for this whānau. They've lost the boy whose birthday celebration this was. I mean, as a mother of teenage sons, that is just heart-wrenching, and it doesn't matter what the social environment is, but it just shows you that level of dysfunction and tragedy that that is still befalling them, and I just think it's awful. I really do think it's awful.
All of those kids have known is people cracking down on them. I think it would surprise a lot of those people with soft hands in the National Party who are just not familiar with those environments how easy it would be to front up to those situations and say to young people, hey, do you want to do something a bit different? You know, you'll learn some stuff. You'll be outside. You'll learn some stuff about your own history. And you'll be a different person at the end of it. Do you want to come? Sign up for a year. Before you get to cracking down on them and getting – because you want to mix.
Yeah.
You know, with the bad eggs, you want some young natural leaders.
Yeah,
and again, you've got to be careful because there are some people who are drawn to that environment because they want to beat the shit out of kids and maybe worse. But if they can get the right people involved in that and even cycle them in, just say, hey, do you want to, you know, if you can pass a police vetting test and maybe some psychological examinations, would you sign up to do it for 4 weeks on minimum wage? Just do it as a public service. You expose those kids. It's amazing when you talk to them how narrow their horizons are.
Yeah.
They just, you know, if you take them into a house and give them a good meal, the look of wonder on their face, if they're exposed to people giving each other shit when there's not an underlying, there might be violence, they are thirsty for those environments, and it's incumbent on us to offer them to them, as it's incumbent on Chris Luxon, if he's going to do any cracking down on gangs, absolutely needs to crack down on the corruption of youth and the abuse of young people by those criminal organisations.
Yeah. Stop highlighting the hopelessness and start actually giving these kids some hope.
Yeah, there's a lot of smart people in those environments, but, yeah. You know, with each head injury and each blackout drunk, a little bit of that potential ebbs away. I hope that wasn't too depressing, folks.
I know, it's not cheery, but it's sort of been the tenor of the show this week, is that there is a lot of, I think, information that we just need to sort of absorb, take on board, and go, right, what are we going to do to make it better? And I think that's, being informed is always the first step in order to be able to make a plan.
Yeah, confronting the problem helps you make a plan to solve it. And, you know, I mean, it's really interesting to see how the media are tying themselves in knots to avoid reality, given the market feedback that they're getting, that people aren't happy with that. You'd think it wouldn't be too much time before they turned around. There was an article saying why Jesse Mulligan, did you see that, is really bored thinking of the future. And it's just an insight into that lovey class, you know?
Most certainly is.
He admits he's completely in the moment when interviewing, but once you're gone, you cease to exist in my brain and in my life. In fact, in the moment is pretty much how he lives most aspects of his life. This is not a positive personality feature, but I don't think about the future at all, he says. To a fault, I'm really bored thinking about the future. I can only get interested in the present. I think as you get older, you get more stuck in your personal ways. Now, it's not his fault, but he's the kind of guy they hire to do that sort of thing. We really need people in the media now who are thinking about the future, because it's coming to smack us in the face, whether we like it or not.
Well,
we better get informed enough to duck.
Yeah, yes, indeed. So on that note, you and I, of course, will do this all again next week. We might have stories about Gizzy on the weekend.
Yeah.
There you go.
Maybe we should go and do some on-the-spot interview.
Oh, there you go. There's a scary thought. All right, thank you very much. If you've got any comments whatsoever for Marty, 2057 is the text number, and inbox@realitycheck.radio is the email address. So thank you very much. Thank you, Marty.
Yeah, thanks, Marie. Have a good week, everyone.
With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Visit www.realitycheck.radio/donate.